Welcome to Listening to the Dead Live. I'm John Watt, so I'm the sometimes presenter of this fine podcast, but mostly I'm just a huge fan of Linda and Kaz's, and they're with me here today. And where are we? We're at CrimeCon 2021 in London, the heart of London by St. Paul's. So we're recording this live for the first time, and to our podcast listeners, wherever and whenever they're listening to this podcast, a very warm welcome. So for this special podcast, what we're going to do is we're going to look back and sort of look at the scenes of this podcast and look at the previous episodes and go through a little trip back through the case history of Listening to the Dead, as it were. So just a little reminder, a trip down memory lane for us. This all began in 2019. And I was looking back over my notes of our first meetings, Linda, and discussing this. And I think most of it was Linda just telling stories, as she does, about her past cases and times she's visited forensic experts in researching her books. And God, the stories are wonderful. And you've shared some of them on the podcast. But it's easy to see where the theme of the podcast came from. But I suppose what we want to get back to is you know, here you are, an award-winning author, screenplay writer, actress, speaker. What on earth made you want to do a podcast now?
Well, in all honesty, I mean, I had no idea what a podcast was. I thought it was something to do with plants. Anyway, the reality is my dependency on experts has been proven from day one when I began writing. And I think the success of so much of my work is literally from the scientists. I mean, they guide me and have done from day one. And I can still approach them. But I think from the podcast, what is very important, it encourages writers. And you can hear me asking so many questions. As science has developed and developed and developed, I'm still asking questions. You can also hear me getting a bit gobsmacked, going, "No, really?" and interrupting. So that's basically, you know, it's my encouraging time for any writer, any crime writer. You know, the podcast is absolutely very, very important.
Well, actually, some of the comments and the feedback we've had are from writers who have enjoyed the podcast because it's delving that little bit deeper into forensics and getting granular right in there. Mm. Because so often people use terms or talk about certain forensic disciplines and then leave it sort of without getting really down and dirty. And that's, I'm hoping, what we've managed to do, and people are telling us what we've managed to do on this podcast, is because we've been so lucky to talk to so many experts. And Kaz, when we were planning this, I remember there was a lot of chat we had about which forensic disciplines we should look at first. Do you remember that?
Yes, yeah, I think because one of the things I think we all felt was that at the end of the day, I mean, if you had, say, like forensic chemistry and you had a chemist talking on a podcast, not being rude to them, they're absolutely brilliant at what they do, but it would start going over an audience's head. And I think people listening just want to know sort of some sort of grassroots forensics, but explained in a way as it, the more complicated sides of it are explained in a way that everybody listening can understand, and I think that's what we aim for. And I like to think that we achieved that, and Linda, we got them to open up and talk to us in an honest and frank way.
Well, I mean, it has been so fascinating because it's one of those things about forensics is, you know, it's just a term that's not big enough to cover how many disciplines and how diverse these disciplines are. You know, you were just talking to Patricia Wilshire, who we'll get to as our first episode. But there she is, forensic botany and ecology. And yet, next week, you could be talking to a firearms expert. And they've both spent 40 years becoming experts in their field. And, as scientists, they're completely different. But they're both, you know, blanket term forensics. You know, and that's what's been so fascinating, to sort of really get down and see these people's skill. I mean, you were invaluable, Kaz, at really introducing us to these people because it was your years working with them that opened the door and allowed us to sort of meet some of these people. So there were a lot of old friends we spoke to.
Yes, yeah, yeah. People I'd worked with, and or I'd being a member of the Chartered Society of Forensic Sciences, people that I'd been lucky enough to meet through that, because I even when I was still working, you know, you get asked by an SIO, we need somebody to look at that. Well, can you tell me so and so? I said, well, I can't, because that's not my field of expertise, but I know somebody who can. And it was great to be able to pick up a phone and call people, and most of them were the people who came on the podcast.
Well, it was like a band reunion, yeah, half the time for you and these forensics episodes. So in fact, if we start with what has been the most listened to, of our series, which was the Forensic Botany and Ecology with Patricia Wiltshire, who is here at CrimeCon this year, talking. She is, one of the world's foremost experts on this area of botany and ecology. And you called her the Pollen Lady, I seem to remember.
That's how you first came across her. Yeah.
It's so basic, yeah. Evil, isn't it? remind us your first memories of working with Pat.
Well, I'd firstly seen Pat talk in the late 90s at a forensic conference, and that's how I got to know her. And then a couple of cases I did with her. Pat always speaks her mind, but she knows her stuff, and she's very honest and tells officers, this is what you need to do. And if you don't listen to her, she's going to get upset. But she's right a lot of the time. And then it was through... Linda had met her through some work she was doing and a couple of books using different plants and poisons and things. And I introduced her to Linda, said, well, this, when Linda asked me about that kind of thing, this is the person you need to speak to, because their depth of knowledge on it is really, really good. So it was over to Linda to get the intricate details of what she wanted for the book.
There was a victim... young girl disappeared. Police searched for 8 solid months, thousands of statements. She just was on her way home from school and gone. And when they went through the evidence, there was absolutely nothing, not a clue. Then 8 months after her disappearance, a body is found in woodland, wrapped in an eiderdown. Her hands were tied behind her back with cords that are used by the post office sorting room. Those plastic ones that when they get very tight round, you can't get them off. And they were around her ankles and her wrists. She also had around her neck a dog collar. And so suddenly the realization, where had this poor little soul been for 8 months? And it was determined pathology-wise that she had been frozen for that time. So now you have a frozen body, you have a dog collar, you have these wraps, and they were unusual, particularly one was yellow. So these are the clues that are there, that they begin as... you know, investigation to find the killer. So what you've got to understand is that there is a police officer whose sole job will be day in, day out, on the phone to every single maker of dog collars and, you know, designs. Do you make this? Where do you sell them? How do you sell them? A very specific dog collar. Then there were dog hairs found on the duvet. So you then have experts. Can these hairs be sent to America, where there is an expert there in testing dog hairs, can come back and say it's a German Shepherd or it is a poodle, whatever. All this is going on as they're slowly getting clues closer and closer and closer to possibly identifying the killer. And then they get in touch with Pat. 8 months in a freezer. Meanwhile, they have a statement saying, oh, there was a guy who used to have a big, tall freezer. Yeah, very nice guy. Has a lot of dogs and things. Local guy. It was Pat examining the body. And with her expertise, she said, you are looking for a back garden. Where the body was dumped, that wasn't where she was murdered. You're looking for a garden because from her tests, she could tell there was still pollen in her hair. She was also able to say there were two fire sites. So from sections that she was able to scientifically bring up, she found essences of fire, not one, but two fires, garden fires. Then she was able to say, you're looking for two kinds of different fruit trees. She also described that the garden would be very, very overrun, unkept, and bingo. As all the police inquiry joined together, dog collar, we got a guy, he's named, the wires trapped in our hands, we've got the names. He worked in and bit by bit, but it was her evidence. When she walked into the garden, she says, fire, fire. This was where her body had been left, put into the freezer, and that really secured the victim's kind of justice. And this is how important her expertise is. It's quite extraordinary. She was able, for example, to say, when nettles are trodden on, nettles take a long time to get back up into position. So sometimes if you find nettles down, they go, the body was laid here. And it could have been 2 days. She can tell you if it was 1 day. She can tell you where the pollen fell from which tree. I mean, it's her expertise, and she has been at the top of her career for about 25 years, wouldn't you say, Cass?
Certainly since the early, I think it was the early 90s or late 80s she first ever got called upon. There was a murder, and just somebody had read an article about what she was doing, and I think went to see her and say, could you apply this to what we do? And which was similar to DNA in a way, applying. And they did, and that's how she kind of like... and then the more cases she dealt with and the more things she found, the more people were, can you come and help us with this one? But, I mean, she was unique at the beginning because she was the only person who did it. So she was running around all over the country dealing with lots and lots of different cases. You know.
But, I remember the jaw just dropped when she started to talk about what she could do. I mean... when you were talking about the nettles, I mean, I remember that one. And it was sort of 2 weeks after, 3 weeks after, someone may have passed through. Then she's looking at the nettle and saying, you can tell by the way that it's regrown and a slight thickening of the stem that that's what's lain down and then grown back up. And that was just, you know, it was extraordinary. And the other one was the path to the body. You could take samples off somebody's clothing, and the layering of the different pollens would show the path they took by the fact that you'd pass this one, then this one, then this one, and it would wipe there. And it was just, you know, it was absolutely remarkable. And it's not surprising it's one of our most popular ones because it is one that defies belief, I think.
I mean, I was lucky enough once on a organised a course thing with her, and I had her as part of the course doing a couple of hours in woodland and that, and when it came to that part, I went on it as well. And I mean, just walking around woods, it takes on a whole new meaning when she explains things and how these get here and how it can help to, you can use it to solve crimes. That's very, very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, we've been very lucky in this podcast. We've spoken to so many experts who are the top of their field, and Patricia's definitely that. And you see how small the world of forensics is in a way, because these people who are at the top of their field tend to work on the big cases, and she worked on the Soham case, you know, famously, which I remember you went to see that case.
Yes, I was in court for that, but also, you know, the respect that people like Pat deserves, because, you know, she doesn't get to her position overnight. You know, a bit of a degree in botany, and oh yes, I'm going to be an entomologist. It's rubbish. And so often, you know, she's infuriated by the lack of respect shown to even, she said she can be called out to a murder investigation. And it's, look, how long are you going to take? Can you hurry it up a bit? And she says, no, I can be here for 4 hours on my hands and knees until I find what I'm looking for. Because it is so detailed, and with 20-odd years experience, she is at the top of her game. And there's a lot of young students coming forward that want to join that and become that. But it is a long, long process. And the admiration for her ability I mean, I couldn't believe it. She just said, oh, I'm 80. Oh, she's got this energy level, this wonderful energy. She's absolutely remarkable and has helped me in a number of cases. You know, poison.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I encourage you, if you haven't read her book, Traces, do.
Yes.
It's a marvellous book, and just, you know, it tells you everything about the field, and it was a fascinating read. So further on in that series, one of my favourites was the fire investigation episode. I remember we went out to see Peter Mansey in his lab in Hertfordshire. And Kaz, you bought your little King Charles Spaniel called Disney. And I remember this very clearly because we were recording a bit with Peter and he was talking about sort of a particularly gruesome fire. And in the middle of this, there was this sort of rumbling on the recording you could hear. And we didn't want to disturb Peter, so we were just sort of looking around, trying to find out what was wrong. Was that, you know, something, was the fridge was on or something like that? And it wasn't. You look around and there's Disney just snoring on her paws. Just, you know. So, yeah, we didn't. So how is Disney, by the way? Still
fine,
helping
yeah,
with your investigations?
Getting on a bit, but yeah, no, still snoring. Still snoring.
Yes.
Yeah, but
there's a number of rumbles, actually, on our podcast where she's there.
Because, you know, with fire, it's very interesting to... As I'm constantly saying, go to source. I know it's been very difficult for the past 18, you know, nearly 2 years to go to source for anything. But I had a fire in the opening of my book, Buried. And I talked to a firefighter. And I said, can you just read what I've put down and tell me how clear? Is this right? And he very diligently went through what was wrong as I described the fire and also at what point the fire trucks, hoses came in. I mean, very small notes. And then he talked about approaching into a burnt out building, the dogs, how they put little padded things on their paws to protect them from the fire, how they track down a dog. Can you imagine a dog's job is to go in and go, okay, the accelerant was in the left room on the right. And so these dogs can actually sniff around and say, this is where they can pinpoint, this is where the fire started. It's quite extraordinary. And he was very, very quiet, very serious. And often I say the point about when you're talking to somebody face to face, you might get an anecdote. That if you were taking it very seriously, you know, on the phone or on the internet, you might not actually get an anecdote. And he'd been very, very serious. And so it was kind of, I just said, oh, thank you very much. You know, and I'd made my notes and it was all over. And he goes, I'll tell you something funny. I said, oh, yes. And he said, yes, sir, my first cadaver. I was very young. Anyway, I went in and, you know, it, very charred remains, and it was my job to bring it out on the stretcher, and a foot broke off. I didn't find that out till, you know, was in the ambulance. And they said, where's his left foot? Oh, I said, I knew I'd dropped it. And so suddenly that is buried, and there it is. There it is, it's buried, you will see. Where's his left foot? But you only get those when you have face-to-face, which is wonderful. And this is why, you know, we're talking about the fire, but you can hear me asking the fire experts in the podcast questions about, you know, how many dogs would you use, how you can identify a cadaver, how dangerous it is. And so consistently, I'm always going to source.
Yeah, and it was really important to go and see Peter in his lab. It was fascinating because you saw just the range of instruments and the lengths they go to when investigating a fire.
I mean, fire investigation it takes a long time. You could be in a house for days, but one of the first things, particularly if you have a body there, because the question is, how did the body, you know, is it been a murder and it's somebody trying to destroy the scene, to destroy the forensics? Of course, when your fire brigade go there, and nature of the beast is that they will kick every door in, smash every window to try and put the fire out, which if you've got a murder is then causing mayhem with your scene. But if you have like a bit of the roofs come down bit by bit as you lift away, And it, sometimes if the body's fallen and it's a smoke inhalation and there's sunburn damage, but you might find a newspaper under it or a bit with a fingerprint. And you can still get fingerprints after fire damage by different treatments. But it's interesting because the fire brigade have their own fire investigation unit, and the forensic science service, as it was then, had its own investigative unit. And you'd have, as a CSI, I kind of had a understanding of it, but no, not the depth that they have, so I would be guided by them. But when you get the two heads or three even working together, how you can reach a conclusion, which is, I think, is more sort of objective as opposed to subjective to what you actually think happened. An example being a guy, he was arrested. There was a fire. His wife died of smoke inhalation. She was upstairs, and the fire had started at the bottom of the stairs. There was an ironing board and clothing on the ironing board that had been set alight. One of the fire investigators said, there's two seats of fire here. There's the fire in the hallway, and there's also a chair by the window there that's gone up in flames. But then when they looked at it closer, what it was, the fire had started here. It built up so much that the smoke and everything in the heat then built, and it tracks across the roof until it meets something else, which was the curtains. And then the curtains ignited, fell down onto the chair, made it look like there was a second seat fire. At the end of the day, it was the wife who'd had a big argument with the husband. She had mental issues, and she had set light going back upstairs. And we were able to find the lighter upstairs and everything. So by them doing, you know, and arguing, you were able to say, no, this man hasn't done anything here. I mean, he could have, in days gone by, found himself arrested, convicted, and in prison. So that side of it was good as well, that you were able to prove that somebody is innocence, and it was actually another tragic side to the events that occurred.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I remember he took us through to the back, and there's enormous loading bay. And it was like, well, what are you using this for? And it's because sometimes they bring the entire scene and recreate it in the lab. So if it was a kitchen, they might rip out the entire kitchen, put it on a lorry, and then recreate it in the lab so that they can then follow a fire. And trace it around, and I just thought that was amazing.
Yeah,
the lengths they'll go to. So that was season one, six episodes. We moved on to season two. Sadly, COVID restrictions meant we couldn't go and see the experts anymore. But I suppose you know, slight silver lining is that we could geographically go to people who are further afield, and we did. We spoke to people from all over the country. And give or take the occasional sort of issue with Kaz's microphone, it all went pretty well. So what are your favourite parts of this series, and what episodes do you remember most, Linda?
Well, the gunshots, you know. It's, again, constantly I'm made aware of, you know, a ballistic expert. You know, his job is to be able to say, that was a rifle. He can match a bullet. He can say how close it was fired to the victim. And so constantly in the ballistic one is me kind of interrupting him all the time and saying, who did it then? Who did it? You know, but that is it's how they fire a gun. I mean, they used to use big, big troughs of sand to test firing. Now they use water, don't they, to...
Yeah, cotton wool at one time they used. Because the cotton wool would... But, of course, with cotton wool or things like sand, if you're using that, if you test fire, you're going to put marks on the bullet, whereas water just stops. Eventually the bullet will just, as it travels through the water, it'll just stop and just sink to the bottom, so you've got it in perfect condition.
And so it was... The experts we really questioned was quite extraordinary. And I remember... I don't know if anyone else is as fascinated with the Jeremy Bamber case as I am, and the questions I have about it, because one is constantly given so much new material about Jeremy Bamber applying for another appeal, and I was actually present at one of his appeals. But it was very firmly put to me when I said, did he fire that gun? And I just got a very firm yes. Didn't want to talk about it, did he?
No.
But it's those fascinating areas in a crime that with the Bamba case, it was finding the silencer. And so, but it's an, again, you know, that astonishing fact that there are experts that are in every different field that you can think of. There is an expert that can say the markings on this bullet, they can piece a bullet together from fragments, and they can say the shooter was standing within 2 feet. And I know on the American TV show, the CSI, you've got all these little laser beams and things, you know. And, oh, yes, well, the bullet came in through the window, hit his nostril, went out of his left ear, up the wall, and landed on the roof. I mean, we do occasionally have a little bit of the lights here and a little bit of the red ribbons, but we're not that quite advanced with the laser lights. But eventually, one will get there, I think. Don't you, Cass?
Yeah, yeah. I've been interested. One of the things with the Bamba case, of course, is that is from the word go, they believed what they were told by Jeremy Bamba. Whether he be innocent or guilty or whatever, at that point in time, you don't take one person's word. You treat it, if you think there's any, if it's suspicious, you treat it as a murder until the investigation proves otherwise. And if you do that, you won't have the problems later, and you've got all the evidence you need. And that didn't happen. Thank goodness, 9 times out of 10 in this day and age, it's all done in that style, and everything is so thorough. It's like it's as watertight as it possibly can be.
Yeah, I think it was one of the most amazing things about this series 2, is that time and again we ended up talking to these experts about cases which are reopened as new forensic evidence comes up. And one of those was within the gunshot wound episode, which was David Pryor was the expert, and he was the first ballistics expert on the scene of the Jill Dando shooting. And we spoke to him about that, do you remember? And, I mean, that one just stayed with me because, you know, he was able to identify that it wasn't that standard pistol, was it? It was a modified firearm that had been shot. And then, Barry George went to prison and then he got out on appeal. So it's another case that has not yet been solved.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I think, though, although correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the police have sort of said we're not looking for anybody else. Interestingly, although there have been certain...
Well, they thought it might be a hitman. But then again, it was sort of David's evidence about the gun was like, well, that sort of odd gun they had is not the sort of thing that a hitman uses.
And he said a hitman wouldn't... Because it was a reconditioned, he believed, starting pistol or an old gun that had been... the barrel being filled in and then bored out again. And also the ammunition. A professional hitman, that's not the kind of thing they would use. Broad daylight as well, professional hitman.
But it was also the grains inside the pocket of the suspect.
Yeah, yeah.
Where identified coming from a weapon. It's very interesting also to find out when they discuss, you know, immediately testing somebody if you fired a weapon, immediately testing your hands. They can last, apparently, about 2 to 3 hours after you've fired, but you will find that, you know, people wash their hands very quickly if they've just pulled a gun, fired a gun, you know, go, where's the bathroom? And the fascination with ballistics and blood splattering, does blood splattering come into the same ballistic?
I had a case where it actually did. We found body parts in a bin bag. One of the torso wasn't because... Fox had ripped it open, and that's how we actually found it on the edge of a golf course. And then we found more parts in that obviously been very, very badly decomposed, had been there for some time. And the victim's head, although badly decomposed, somebody carved a cross into it, and she'd been shot with an air rifle, and the pellet was still, which was a most strange item to use, and it wasn't. We knew who she was. We found out about her. She had been a prostitute. She had a drink problem. But nobody knew who had killed her. And we did appeals, everything. The bags, we couldn't find prints or anything on the bags. But then it was about a year later, a cab driver said, oh, I happened to read there was a reappeal, and he doesn't read newspapers, he doesn't watch the news. He said, somebody left a paper in my cab, and I read it, and I saw you. He said, I saw, on I think the night that you were interested in, this man walking across the road with a limp who was carrying a black bin liner. Yeah. Whereas he said, well, he was coming out of the flats there. It turned out he was the guy who lived above. And when we went into his house, we found a cupboard. When you opened the cupboard, there was a picture from a sex magazine where he'd been firing air pellets at it. Then in another cupboard was the air rifle, spotless, clean, had all been cleaned. Oh, and the picture had a black cross on the forehead. And he denied anything to do with it at all. But we found that when the gun had obviously been well cleaned, so we thought, but Dave Pryor, when they looked down the barrel of the gun, there was her blood. And his story then became, well, I was cleaning it and it accidentally went off, an air rifle. But the argument was, Dave said, well, even if that did happen, by the time it hit where you say she was in, there'd be no velocity in it, so it would hurt. It might go in a bit, but it's not going to kill you.
And when they examined inside, because of the blood, he was able to say that had to have been held literally right against the head for that blood to get back down. It's the back spatter. As the bullet, as it goes in, it sends the back spatter of blood down it. And because of that as well, we then went and examined the bathroom, and there was somebody put down the sealant, but there was one little gap like that, tiny, tiny little gap where it hadn't been done properly. And then when we pulled all that away and looked under the bath, where it obviously cut her up on the bathroom floor, and all the blood had seeped through. So we had just a little bit, but it DNA'd back to her, so we could say that. So that's, yeah, blood in shootings, yeah, plays its part.
Dave Pryor was one of the best, wasn't he? Absolutely amazing guy. And I was really fascinated because he talked about setting up, being instrumental in setting up the ballistics database, where, you know, so individual weapons leave individual unique markings on a casing. And so they started using this ballistics database to be able to track a gun by its crimes because of the casing. So you can start to see how a gun has moved around and identified. And I just thought, you know, that's not necessarily the sexy part of forensics, but God, it was just fascinating, you know, incredibly useful. And the stuff like that, it's getting better and better and more detailed.
Well, he had another case which I'd forgotten that he'd dealt with till we did the podcast. I had a guy who was shot dead in Erith, but he still had a bullet from when he had been shot 7 years ago in his shoulder. So I said, well, look, why don't we take this one as well? Just, you know, hell of it, really, to see and compare it to the two bullets that have killed him. Lo and behold, it was the same gun that had killed him that was used on him 7 years earlier, which automatically gave a suspect, because the guy in that was he went to trial, but it turned out the victim who survived that time round was told a lie to try and get this guy convicted, and the case was thrown out, but it clearly was him. And then 7 years later, the same gun, but this time we knew it wasn't him because he'd hired somebody of a different colour to shoot him this time. But with his gun.
Well, our most popular episode from season two was the last one, Cause of Death Unknown. Clearly, our listeners love a mystery as much as the rest of us, your readers. It was an amazing episode, a sort of feature-length bumper episode with two guests, Rob Jeffries from the Thames River Police, and then the wonderful Angela Gallup, who is one of the UK's leading forensic scientists investigating famous cold cases. Kaz, you were invaluable in pointing us in the direction of the Thames River Police, who I think you'd worked with quite a lot in the past.
Generally with bodies that are found in the Thames, and you know, were they pushed, did they fall, or any sort of injuries to them, or cases where bodies have been, it's quite clear that after a post-mortem they've been murdered, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the cases that he spoke about there is the torso in the river case, which actually is it's 20 years old now, it's still unsolved, and there was just an article on it. What they were saying is that that at first they went to Thames River Police to see if they could work out the movement of the body, and they were just like, the Thames, like unlike other rivers, is completely unpredictable.
You can have somebody go into the water and drown here, and you will find them upstream or downstream, and it might be 4 or 5 days, because what happens is that the gases in your body, as you decompose, the gases form, and that's what brings you back up. That's why it can be quite a long time before you can actually find a body. But interestingly, what you can do sometimes with things called diatoms, you can try and, from the diatom, say where they, the diatom expert can be able to tell you, well, this is where I would think they might have gone in, so you need to look around that area if they were, you know, murdered and thrown in.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're 12 wonderful episodes so far, Linda. What have you taken away from these first two series?
Well, that probably I've taken away that I may think I know scientifically what I'm talking about, but in reality, I really need their expertise at all times.
Yeah, I think we've all learned a heck of a lot. Yeah. What about you, Kaz?
He knows it all anyway.
It's in a way like that, because for me, until I became a CSI, I was a detective. I was a detective sergeant who worked. I'd started working on murders in 1978, and so I'd worked. And it was all before there was murder squad. You dealt with them on divisions, so we were always busy. Then went on the murder squad. Then became a CSI. But I didn't know a lot about forensic science. I thought I did, but then I suddenly realised, actually, I don't know how this is. How do you apply this? I can't ask the scientists the right questions. If I don't understand what they do and why you've reached those conclusions and have a good working knowledge of it, how can I challenge them? And how would I know if further evidence comes in that they need to know that? So I really got into learning as much about all the different forensic sciences and sitting down with scientists and talking to them. It's exactly for Linda Reiner's books, does exactly the same. But it opened up gave me a much better understanding, and I just wish that they gave police officers more training, particularly senior investigators, murder investigators, in what forensic science is, how it works, etc. If you ask a detective to help, do you understand what a likelihood ratio is in forensic science? No, I haven't got a clue. So, well, actually, it's when you look at the sort of the prosecution proposition against the defence proposition. And if you apply that to an investigation, even before you get to trial, well, this is what this evidence tells me. But however, that tells me that I might be wrong there. So you constantly challenge yourself all the time until you get, you know, an objective theory that may or may not be the truth, but it's a good one to work from, instead of, like, you know, you did it, I know you did it, I'm going to find everything to prove you did it. Which is the way, it's not a deliberate thing. It's just the nature of detectives. Sometimes I think they want to get the person, and you can't see the wood for the trees, and you find what you do is you get the stuff that fits what you believe to have been the case.
One of the biggest unsolved murders in the U.S. is the Black Dahlia, and the gruesome discovery of a dismembered girl. She was severed at the waist and found in quite an exclusive area in Los Angeles. And one of the horrors was that her mouth had been slit from ear to ear, so it looked as if she was like a clown's face. So I began to research a thing called the Red Dahlia, and it was like a copycat murder. And so we had to find a very, very good maker of the dummy, because there was a lot of attention on the discovery of the mutilated, beautiful girl. Her name was Elizabeth Short. And so it was very costly, the mouth, because we would have a camera close-up of her face. So it had to be very realistic, and it cost an absolute fortune. You know, it was about £9,500, but very realistic. So when the shooting ended, somebody said, what are we going to do with the body? I said, hang on a second, you're not going to chuck that. I'm having it. I'll take it home. Because always I thought we could maybe shove it together and use it again somehow. So I had this dismembered body, beautiful hands and everything, and it was wrapped in a very large black tarpaulin in my cellar. And at the time, I had a Great Dane. Bates, his name was, and he would occasionally disappear down to the cellar. But I'd not checked recently. Gas man. He said, hello, I've come for the gas. I said, you're down the cellar. It's a meter straight ahead of you on the left-hand side. So he goes down these very steep steps. I then hear a howl of terror that I've never heard the like of. And I thought, my God, the dog's, where's the dog? So I'm looking for the dog. This man comes out. He goes, here we got a bunny. Here we got a bunny in the cellar. Here we got a terrible bunny in the cellar. And I said, oh, no, no, it's not a body. It's the red dahlia. And he goes, I can't tell you, this poor man, he had to be given a brandy. And I explained to him, look, it's a dummy. I'm so sorry. And he said, it's all right. I'm never coming back here.
And you've got free gas for life. Well, what a fine note to end on. Thank you, Linda. Thank you, Kaz, for two wonderful series so far. Thank you, everyone at CrimeCon, for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to be here. We've loved it. We've met so many interesting people. I think some of them might even appear on the third season of Listening to the Dead. We can announce now. That's it. We are going to announce. We are having a third season. It's coming in early 2022. And we'll be looking at some famous cases and the forensics that broke them. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so already, and new episodes will pop into your feed. Until then, check out Linda's website for more details on the podcast and her books. And otherwise, thank you again for listening wherever you've listened to this, and see you all soon.